Hello everyone, I'm Master B and welcome to Today in Tech episode 19. This episode was recorded on February 27th, 2010. And today I have an interview with Sigflup. Enjoy.
My only purpose is to bring Santa Claus back to Mars. All this trouble over a fat little man in a red suit.
Billy, what does a Martian look like?
Fat little man in a red suit. My only purpose is to bring Santa Claus back to Mars.
Hello, boys and girls!
Hello, Sigflup. Welcome to TIT Radio.
Oh, hi. How are you on? How's it going?
Good. You have a Hacker Public Radio series called Demo or Bust.
Yes, I do.
Demo or Bust seems like it's geared towards someone that's already part of the demo scene. Could you explain to me and the TIT listeners what a demo is?
Yeah, most certainly. And I, of course, am by no means authoring myself as like a bona fide member of the demo scene, if that makes sense. But a demo typically is a program that has no interaction, that does some sort of audio or visual presentation, and that's about it. Like, it's kind of a community of sorts, and a lot of people like to run demos on various platforms, and it's kind of a challenge. Can we get something running? Can we get this effect going on a Commodore 64 or something like that? And it's quite a lot of fun. Friendship and creativity, those are the two primary forces in the demo scene, as far as I understand.
So when it comes to hardware and equipment, you can use anything you want?
Anything that runs programs. I mean, there's also, like, mind you, again, like, I don't want to place myself as an authoritative voice when it comes to the demo scene, because I'm relatively new to it myself. But usually this goes along with parties, and usually they're competitions, and they have different categories, and these categories maybe are separated by platform or type of demo, and they're usually the wild demo too, so really anything creative is usually smiled upon. But the calculators, there's my mate wrote a demo for the PI-85 calculator, for instance. Anything from calculators to high-end GPUs, whatever runs the programs.
And then when you say competition, I mean, is there like a bunch of people there, judges? How does that work?
It's usually judged by the audience, and there is some sort of voting mechanism, and that's usually how it goes. I haven't been to too many parties, but this is what I understand from the parties that I've been to.
Now, I see Nauticon's going to have a party coming up. Well, Nauticon's like April 15th through 18th.
Let me double check. Are you okay? So is that verified? Do you know that it's that? Because I don't know offhand.
Here, let me look it up real quick. And that's Nauticon. I'm saying that right, correct?
Yeah, Nauticon.org.
Yeah.
15th through the 18th, my friend. Cleveland,
okay.
Ohio.
46 more days.
Yeah. You're looking at the website. There it is. 26 more days.
Now, is that separate from Nauticon, or is that like just like a special event there?
So it's the demo competition block party is separate from Nauticon, but it is there. Like, in spirit, it's separate, but it's very similar. There's a lot of cross-pollinization when it comes to the audience and the participants. All the hackers go to Nauticon, and all the demo people go to the Nauticon as well, and then the demo people shine at block party, and the hackers kind of shine at the hacker part. So it's kind of like a sister organization, if that makes sense. So my friend NRR, let's say NR for whatever reason, NRR recently held a party in Magfest, which was a similar thing called Nurupu. And so Nurupu is a part of Magfest, as Block Party is part of Nauticon. Everyone should come. 26 more days. Get your tickets.
So you're going to be there, right?
I'm going to try to. I'm going to try to. That's not quite a guarantee. There might be something happening, but I'm going to definitely try to. Scott will be there. Radman will be there. The Northern Dragons will be there. I believe Black Pawn is going, so he's a senior from Seattle. He'll be there. And, I don't know, just the American scene, Phoenix, Trickster, all those people will be there.
So is it mainly just, like, people, like, into competition there, or is there, like, people just walking around taking a look at everybody's demos, or is it pretty much everyone there is actually competing, or they have something to show?
I wouldn't homogenize everyone. Like, it's, everyone's doing things different. Some people are working on a production. There's a, usually, there's like a break room, and everyone sets up their computers there, and people who want to enter usually work on a production there. And we have found that a lot of people do it the day of. So there's a lot of party coding. There's a lot of party tracking and putting together productions during the party. Some people are looking around. Like, it's a mass of people, so you can't really say what anyone is doing at the same time. It's interesting, though. Like, the Linux community, I mean, Linux is becoming very practical. Well, it's not. It's practical more so than it was in 1991, say, or even in 96. And, but, you know, the geeky sort of computers for the sake of computers running Linux, albeit maybe unpractical, but still doing it anyway, I think mirrors the demo scene spirits of let's produce something cool that has no real purpose, but it's cool anyway. And so there's a lot of shared energy between the more hacker scene, not a con, and the more demo scene oriented block party.
Yeah, because to me, looking at the screenshots of you know, of the party, it kind of looks just like a bunch of people getting together playing music, because I had no idea all this was going on. I mean, there's a lot of coding involved, and you have to have some kind of, I don't know, some kind of knack for graphics, and I mean, not anybody could just buy some computers and think they're going to jump right into this. This takes a lot of skills, doesn't it?
I hate to say this, but some of the entries have been pretty, I don't want to say crap, because they're interesting. Like, whatever, any level of skill, you draw whatever. Like the graphics competition, if you could draw something with a mouse, you should enter. If you can do anything, you have to start somewhere, right? So, I don't know, it seems like the more popular productions are the ones that are more well done. For instance, there is, to every Farbrush, there is, Farbrush being this European demo group that has really good productions and has developed some really good tools. For every beautiful Farbrush production, there are hundreds of other sort of minimal productions, but you got to start somewhere. And some of them are very charming, and some of them are very cute. So it's not all about skill. It's about whatever energy you want to put into it. And also about skill. it's about a lot of different things. Did you want to go anywhere aside from the demo scene, or did you want to talk specifically about that?
One more question about the demo scene.
Yeah.
Like, if I walked into the demo party and walked up to your table or area, I mean, what would I see on your table?
On my table or someone else's table?
Your table, say. I mean, what kind of equipment do you bring, or?
I usually bring my laptop. That's about it. Like, there really isn't too much else that I'm going to carry. So, like, for me, like, if you came last year, you probably would have seen me working on Sega Genesis code and drawing a little bit. To put together a couple of effects there. But if you go to other people's tables, maybe you'll see them tracking. There's a big, pretty big tracker crowd there. And so you'll see a lot of that. See people doing whatever they do. So people using whatever tools, albeit their own or others, make interesting productions.
So the Sega Genesis, you like to hack on that? I mean, is there other things you do with it besides make demos?
No, not really. Like, I've noticed that in my own personal life, I need to learn more discipline. And I found that I will stick to something for maybe a few months. And the Sega Genesis, I kind of like, oh, well, I don't know too much about the Sega Genesis. That sounds interesting. I'll learn about the Sega Genesis for a little under half a year. And wrote a library to facilitate programming on it, and a spread editor, as well as a patch patch editor for the sound chip that's in it, one of the sound chips that's in it, and did a panel on it as well. Let me get you the URL to the panel if you ever want to watch it.
All righty, I'll put that in the show notes, too.
All right, yeah, I'll paste it in the VIC room once I get over to what the URL actually is. You can see my greasy face. I was very greasy during that presentation, but that's beside the point. Right, that's a rather long URL. Hopefully you can see that.
I got it. I'll put that in the show notes. I'll have to watch it later once we get off the call.
Right, cool beans. Mind you, that I tend to switch a lot of terms. I've noticed that I tend to not think what I say. And so, like, I think I said Nintendo a couple times instead of the Sega Genesis and vice versa, and sometimes I say bits instead of bytes. But if you think about it, like, it'll probably hopefully come to you what I mean. But it's not so bad. Just a minor criticism of my own style there. The Sega Genesis is an interesting, it's a real interesting system as far as systems are concerned. I mean, I said the same thing about the Nintendo when I was doing Nintendo stuff, but I think for every system, I think it's interesting. But the Sega Genesis is one that I kind of grew up with, or at least my friend grew up with, and I would go over and watch him play video games, right? But the Nintendo, not so much. Didn't have a Nintendo, but I had a Sega Genesis.
No, Sega, the one with, does that have a CD or is that a cartridge?
I had both. Buy just a Sega Genesis, you have a cartridge, and then you have a Sega CD if you want, and that would be it. And a CD extension. There was one for the Super Nintendo as well, but I don't think it was marketed very well, but the systems were different back then, like the video game systems. There wasn't a frame buffer or anything like that. There was because the hardware was limited on memory for video memory, albeit the Sega Genesis had enough video memory for a frame buffer, but that wasn't the mindset at the time. The hardware before that was limited by memory, where you can't store pixels, so you have to store some representation of pixels. Typically, these are sprites and whatnot, so you can have maybe 32 by 32 sprites on the screen, and then store 8 by 8 sprites, maybe 100 of them somewhere else, and you reduce the amount of memory that you need to draw something, albeit it can't be, the complexity of it is not so complex that you can have per pixel sort of, it can't be per, it's like, I don't know, it's so complex that you can have a randomness per pixel, if that makes sense. But the same thing with the Nintendo. The Nintendo, of course, used sprites, and it seems like we go through these paradigms. Right now, it was sprites before, right now we're kind of in the sort of rasterization of triangles paradigm and GPU paradigm. Where this will go from here, I don't know. Maybe real-time ray tracing is a paradigm or something like that for graphics. You can do all sorts of neat tricks. You can it had horizontal scrolls and vertical scrolls and a couple of back planes and a sprite plane and a window and whatnot. A programmable interrupt per horizontal line, which is very nice, and stuff like that. I've been thinking about writing an emulator for the Sega Genesis. I wrote one for the Nintendo, and that was quite a lot of fun. And maybe I'll pick that up again and do one for the Sega Genesis. We'll see.
Yeah, that'd be pretty cool. I mean, how do you dump a ROM from a cartridge?
Well, okay. So I don't have any hardware for the Sega Genesis to dump ROMs, but because I don't have an EEPROM programmer anymore. But I'll tell you how it was for the Nintendo. I think actually maybe all Duck Hunt is for me on ROM, like. There was no Duck Hunt, and then there's Duck Hunt, because I dumped Duck Hunt, and maybe this is for me, I'm not entirely sure. But anyway, for the Nintendo, what I did was you'd open up the cartridge on the Nintendo, and there'd be two chips, two ROM chips, so they'd be 8-bit chips, which is perfect, because I had this EEPROM programmer, and you'd stick it in the EEPROM programmer, and that had a serial connection to a computer, and then you can dump out what's in the ROM. Or you could make a connector for the edge of the cartridge, and so you don't have to take apart the cartridge, and do it that way. These cartridges essentially are ROM. In the Sega Genesis, it's more likely ROM than ROM in something else. In the Nintendo, most of the cartridges are ROM, but they also have what are called mapper chips, which makes it a little bit more difficult to figure out how to dump what you should dump from the ROM chips. But it's just a matter of reading the chips, right? I mean, theoretically, you could. I don't know. I don't know if you could actually do this, but maybe you can boot off a flash ROM from off your motherboard and then going into your operating system, and hopefully you won't be utilizing anything from your flash ROM, and maybe you could just replace that with a ROM from your game system and read the ROM that way. Like, that might be the cheapest way to do it, albeit, I don't know, it would have to be pin compatible with flash ROM to ROMs, but there are a lot of flash ROMs that are pin compatible, so maybe you can make an adapter or something like that.
Very interesting. When you made that Nintendo emulator, I mean, did you pretty much tear the hardware apart and see how it worked first, or?
No. I talked to this person, this Russian person, who has made a whole lot of emulators. I'm really impressed by the work he's done with. He's written emulators for the Game Boy, the MSX, the Nintendo, of course, the Game Gear, and so on and so forth. And so I talked to him, and he wrote a doc called NES.doc, which is a more or less basic description of Nintendo. Okay, so this is, for anyone who's writing emulators, this is kind of a suggestion. This is how I first, and maybe you want to version something, but what I did immediately was try to emulate the processor, which was very fortunate because this person, Merritt, who wrote these emulators, also wrote a couple of processor emulators, one for the Z80, one for the 6502. And the 6502 is what's in the Nintendo. So I took his emulation code, and I just wrote something to emulate the ROM and the RAM, and saw if I could run Nintendo ROM dumps from it. And it turned out I could. So that you could see that the actual software is running. And then from there, you further emulate more of the machine. So, like, the first step, I think, the important step for emulating any system is emulating the processor. Because from there, you can verify that the code is actually running. And once the code is running, you can figure out how to do the rest of it. And the documentation for any emulation project that you're going to do probably sucks. And so if you can write your own ROMs and test it on a real system, this is something that you should do. Because it won't be immediately clear. Like, for instance, the Nintendo is 114 cycles per scan line. That wasn't immediately clear to me, so you might have to run something to test that and whatnot.
That's pretty neat. Do you play games on the emulators, or you just pretty much just like to program them?
I just like to program them. I only wrote, like, aside from this paper emulator that I'm writing right now, I've only written one emulator, and that was for practice, and I'm kind of like Dunware. Like, I only do things once. I'm not very good at maintaining things, so my emulator is very old, but I don't really run too many games and play them. I find I don't really have patience for games. It's kind of weird. I don't know, like, I don't know how you grew up, but I grew up watching my friends play video games, I think, a lot more than actually playing them myself, and I think that has sort of conditioned me to not actually want to play them, but watch them. So.
Yeah, I really didn't play. Well, we got an Apple II Plus computer, like, in the late 70s.
Yeah.
And that's where I did most of my gaming. And then probably a few years after that, I got the Atari 2600, which I thought just sucked. I mean, the graphics were awful. I mean, even back then, it was just like, ugh. Because I was used to playing stuff in the arcade, and then, you know, you play Space Invaders in the arcade, and then you go home and play it on the Atari 2600. It's like, this is awesome.
Yeah. It was a horrible system. It really was. The 2600 is weird, though, because it had only one scan line worth of video memory. It had pretty much no video memory, so you had to bang out the pixels as they came. And that programming challenge, I think, made for sucky games. So your Apple IIe, did you have a modem with that? Did you ever hit up any of the Apple boards or anything like that?
It was an Apple II Plus. I think it was like the very first ones. But I'm pretty sure my dad paid like $4,000 for this thing back then.
Yeah.
And he ended up getting a modem like 2 years later. And I really never messed with the bulletin board services. He pretty much got on there. And once in a while, I might have got on there with his account just to download a game. Or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, we did have the disk drive, the modem, and we didn't have a monitor, we just had a TV, because you could hook those up to a regular TV.
Yeah, as it was for a lot of computers back then. I had Well, the first computer we had was a Commodore VIC-20, but that doesn't really count. For whatever reason, like, I didn't stick to it. But as soon as we got our Atari ST, we got an Atari 1040 ST, that's when I started getting computers. Fortunately, we had a modem with us. We had an Atari 1040 ST, and it was a pretty cool system. It was a pretty cool system. It seems that there is a pretty big Atari ST, or at least there was a pretty big Atari ST demo scene. I didn't know that at the time. Had I known, I probably would have been most aware of the demo scene far earlier than I am now.
Did the Atari have a disk drive?
Oh, yeah. It had a 3.5 floppy inch disk drive. 720K, as far as I remember. Had a 68K, so 16-bit processor. Same processor that is in the Nintendo. I'm sorry, in the Sega Genesis. Same processor that's in the PI-92 and 89 calculators. Same processor that's in a lot of systems at the time. And it had a right powerful processor. Had a cheap-ass sound chip, but that was okay, because the processor was pretty good, and you can produce some sound that way. It had a GUI, the first computer that I have seen with a GUI. Not too unlike Mac OS at the time, I imagine. I don't know. It was a pretty cool computer.
Wasn't it backwards compatible with, like, the older Ataris?
Not the 8-bit Atari computers. There was no backward compatibility as far as I know of.
Because there was, a gaming console after the 2600. I think it was the Atari 5200.
Yeah, the Atari 5200. Actually, I just sold one of those. I used to have two for whatever reason. But
that wasn't compatible with the Atari 8-bit computers.
I actually think it was. I think it used a Pokey chip and used a lot of the same hardware. I forget what Atari computer it is most compatible with, but there's a particular model that is, like, pretty much just like that. I didn't really have the Atari computers. I'm not too familiar with those, but... I hear the 5200 was very similar to one of their computer lines.
Then our second home computer was a Commodore 64, and it had the disk drive, and it was, I mean, the disk drive was slow. It could actually take 10 minutes to load up a program.
It was horrible. We had a Commodore 64, too, and there's this game that we used to play called Below the Root, and our disk drive, we had to hold it together with the pliers. Whenever we would switch screens, like, you'd cramp your hand waiting for the screen to change while loading the disk. It's fun being nostalgic, huh? There's a lot of, it's amazing how quickly computers change, and the nostalgia of old computers is never lost on anyone who's experienced them because they have changed so much. It's not like, we have this cell phone and now we have this cell phone. It's like, no, things are completely different.
But growing up, though, you'd, like, see the system, you're like, how could anything get any better than this?
Yeah, I remember seeing Doom, and I'm like, oh, my God, it's like I'm watching a movie, holy shit. And now I watch Doom, and it looks horrible.
Yeah, it's awful.
In comparison to real life. But you ever have Doom games or anything like that?
Yeah, I think I still have them somewhere.
Yeah. Have you ever, like, got the computers together and played Doom with your friends?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we used to play over the modem, too.
Yeah, you used to do it over the modem? Did you ever play multiplayer games, or was it just the deathmatch between two players?
We would just play, like, a two-player, like, team.
Okay.
Any more than that, it would just slow down too much, you know, over the phone line. I mean, it was pretty reliable over I think it was 14.4K modem.
Yeah, it's not much for Doom, as far as the data that's sent for Doom. Maybe it's kind of dorky, sort of spitting out random facts, but just kind of as an interesting side note, a lot of the communication that was sent back and forth in Doom, if you just played with modems, was just the controller information. Each computer was playing a multiplayer game, and it was just like you had separate keyboards, right? So,
if you ever want to join in on another round table, you know, or join in on a round table, you're more than welcome to call in any time.
Oh, yeah, I'll keep that in mind. I think actually Lost in Bronx is doing a round table on this sci-fi movie. Should we say goodbye and stop this before we can't hear each other anymore?
Yeah, we probably should.
Is there anything else that you're interested in hearing about, perhaps?
Well, I think we covered a lot, and we've been talking for over 40 minutes, and the connection's kind of getting kind of crappy right now, so we should probably end it before we get disconnected.
Yeah, I don't know how much you are hearing this edited audience in the future, but it sounds pretty horrible. But the so thank you. I appreciate it. And kit radios for life.
All right. Thank you. And I'll talk to you later.
All right. You take care.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. Another tit radio in the can. This is Terry once again from the Juiced Penguin. 2 weeks ago, I think it was 2 weeks ago, that the instant request for a country song went over so well, I'm going to play another one. This is a song by Bradley West called Slow Train.
Slow train, coming down that freedom track. Slow train, coming on down that freedom track. Don't need money in your sack, fancy suit on your back. Ride the slow train. Slow train, all got children ride for free. Slow train, got children get to ride for free. Don't need no stained glass recipe or a college PhD. Ride the slow train. Slow train, hop on up while we still can. Slow train, let's hop on board while we still can. Just call on the name of a sinner's only friend. Ride the slow train. Come on, ride, y'all. Coming out the stack. Oh, slow train, fire and smoke coming out that stack. Heading down the history track, ain't never coming back. I'm on the slow train. Slow train, coming down that freedom track. Coming on down that freedom track. Don't need no bread in your sack, fancy suit on your back. Ride the slow train. Yeah, don't need no degree, theology or fame. Ride the slow train. Slow train.
Public Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.